Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's great having you join me again for another conversation that is always expanding our awareness, expanding our horizons, and as I like to say, it's empowering us with truthful information so we can really make those informed decisions in our life. And today we're going to be exploring a really fascinating topic. So I want to ask you, all of those listening, do you have teenagers? Do you work with teenagers? Will you be having teenagers soon? Are your children going to go through that stage of life? Well, this is a conversation that is really going to allow us to understand and get into the brains of teenagers, which is actually quite an amazing world and quite confusing, and for parents and counselors and teachers can be quite a foreign terrain. And to help us interpret the world of our teenagers' brains and to understand the new science of adolescence is my guest today, Dr. Lauren Steinberg. A little bit about Dr. Steinberg. He is a distinguished university professor and Laura H. Carnell Professor of Psychology at Temple University, an internationally recognized expert on psychological development during adolescence. Dr. Steinberg's research has focused on a range of topics of the study of contemporary adolescence, including adolescent brain development, risk-taking and decision-making, parent-adolescent relationships, school year employment, high school reform, and juvenile justice. Dr. Steinberg is formerly the president of the Division of Developmental Psychology of the American Psychological Association and of the Society for Research on Adolescence, former director of the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Adolescence Development and Juvenile Justice, and a member of the MacArthur Foundation's Research Network on Law and Neuroscience. He served as a member of the National Academy's Board on Children, Youth, and Families, and chaired the Academy's Committee on the Science of Adolescence. Dr. Steinberg was the lead scientist in the preparation of the American Psychological Association's amicus brief submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court in Roper v. Simmons, which abolished the juvenile death penalty, Graham v. Florida, which banned the use of life without parole for juveniles convicted of non-homicidal crimes, and Miller v. Alabama, which prohibited the use of mandatory life without parole for all juvenile crimes. Dr. Steinberg is the author of approximately 350 articles and essays on growth and development during the teenage years, and the author, co-author, or editor of 17 books. He has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and Psychology Today, and is a regular guest on NPR. He also appeared on the Today Show, Good Morning America, 2020 Dateline, and PBS NewsHour, and many other TV programs. And he is also the author of the recently published book, The Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Dr. Steinberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, I am too, because this is a really profound topic we're going to be exploring. What is going on in the brains of our teenagers? And I know many a parent would like to have that roadmap to help, because it is a different time than other stages of life. And maybe that's a good place to start. Just what goes on? What is the brain of a teenager all about?
Well, what we now know is that there is a great deal of brain maturation that continues throughout adolescence and into young adulthood. I think that for a long time people felt or believed that there wasn't a great deal of brain development after childhood had concluded, because the brain reaches its adult size by the time people are 11 or 12. But once we were able to use brain imaging to look inside the brain, we could see that there were many, many changes going on inside in how the brain functions during adolescence. So there are three that I think are really important for parents to understand. The first, and which occurs around the time of puberty and actually has a lot to do with the impact of sex hormones on the brain, is that the brain's reward centers become much more easily aroused. This is because there's an increase in the brain of activity involving the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is the one that's most important for our experience of pleasure. Simply put, when you're a teenager, good things feel even better. And this is often what is responsible for teenagers engaging in a lot of risky and reckless behavior, because they're searching out exciting and potentially pleasurable experiences and not paying attention to what the downside might be. So that's kind of stage one in adolescent brain development. The second important change is a strengthening of the part of the brain known as the prefrontal cortex, which is the part right behind your forehead, and which is really kind of the brain's CEO. And that leads to much more effective and efficient processing in areas that involve decision-making and planning and self-regulation, self-control. So as that part of the brain develops, kids become much better at that. And that's pretty much done by the time people are 15 or 16 years old. Then the third stage really has to do with interconnecting the brain, the development of much better structural connections between different brain regions, which then allows these regions to kind of work together and involve themselves in crosstalk. And that's very important for things like emotion regulation and self-control, because now the brain CEO, the prefrontal cortex, is in constant communication with the more emotional and social centers of the brain. So those are the three main changes that take place over the course of adolescence.
So what does that look like in the behavior of adolescents? And when we talk about adolescence, what's the age range we're talking about?
Well, that's complicated, and as I explained in the book, it's been changing. So I think of adolescence as beginning when kids go through puberty and ending when they make the transition from the roles of adolescence to the roles of adulthood, like full-time employment or settling into a marriage or a serious premarital relationship or becoming economically independent. And what we see, and what I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about, is that if we define adolescence this way, it's really become a much longer stage than it has been in the past, because the age of puberty has been falling, and the age at which people become adults has been rising. And so adolescence now, it's probably a 15-year period for most people. And so I think of it as beginning kind of around 10 and ending at around 25. But it's a moving target because it's changing.
And I just want to make a comment to the fact that you said that puberty is getting younger. And it's true. I mean, I've been looking at the statistics. I've written about this. The average age of puberty in the United States right now is about 10.9 or something like that, 10.5 years of age. But we're seeing precocious puberty showing up in 8- and 9-year-olds. So is that affecting their brains when they have such an early blossoming of puberty and their hormones are changing?
Yes. And this is something that is not often discussed. The pediatricians around the country are reporting an increase in the number of girls they're seeing at age 7 or 8, even showing the signs of breast development, which are the first signs of puberty in females. I think a lot of the attention has been on how this is affecting kids in terms of their outward appearance, maybe in terms of their sexuality, but what we now know is that sex hormones affect the brain in ways that go well beyond increasing our libido and leading to further cascading changes that affect our bodies. So the arousal of these reward centers that I talked about before, which is due to the impact of sex hormones on the brain, is occurring at an earlier and earlier age because puberty has been occurring at an earlier and earlier age. And as I think I'm sure you know, given your work, going through puberty early places women at much greater risk of cancer, breast cancer and cervical mm-hmm. cancer in particular. So it is not a good thing that our children are maturing mm-hmm. earlier.
So let's go back to those three stages of brain development during adolescence. How does that play out in real life? What does it look like?
So I think during the first part of adolescence, let's say from about age 10 until around 15 or 16, kids tend to be more emotionally labile, and they have higher highs and lower lows, and that's because a lot of the emotion centers of the brain are being affected by the hormonal changes of puberty, because a lot of those changes are affecting the part of the brain we call the limbic system, which is the sort of emotional center of the brain. And I think this is the age in which parents often experience a lot of bickering and squabbling with their kids, and their kids seem super sensitive to emotions, very sensitive to social information, so they're very attentive to what their peers think of them. They're very both interested in gossip and hurt by gossip a lot because of the changes in parts of the brain that are affected by puberty. And so I think in some regards, this is the most challenging part of adolescence for most families. The average age of onset for a serious mental illness is 14. And most serious mental health problems make their first appearance during the adolescent years. And it's partly because of this. The other point that I want to make, and actually for the main message of the book, is that this is a time when the brain is also very malleable and very much affected by experience. It's a time of what neuroscientists call plasticity. And so this is a time when it's critical to make sure that kids have healthy experiences and that we keep them away from unhealthy ones because, for example, the impact of drugs on the brain before age 15 is much, much worse than it is later in late adolescence or early adulthood. So that's sort of stage one. Stage two, when the prefrontal cortex is maturing, is a time of growing self-control and impulse control. And I think a lot of parents have remarked to me that they notice a big change in their teenager's behavior at around age 15 or 16. And partly that's because these systems that are important for self-regulation are coming online, and certain aspects of that brain system are actually just as mature in 16-year-olds as they are in adults. So if we give young people this age tests of logical reasoning or planning, that they often perform just as well as adults do, with one caveat. And the caveat is that their intellectual functioning is a little more fragile and it's a little more easily disrupted. So in our lab at Temple, we study the impact of peers on adolescent decision-making. And what we find in many of our experiments is that when adolescents are alone, their decision-making looks a lot like that of adults. But when you put them in groups and they're exposed to the influence of their friends, and not just explicit encouragement, but just being around their friends, it changes the way that their brains work, and it makes them take more risks, and it makes them much more sensitive to rewards. I think that for a parent, the adolescent's maturity at this age, around 15 or 16, will have a kind of now you see it, now you don't quality to it, because things have not yet stabilized. Then during this last stage, I think you will just notice from age 16 on that your young person is becoming more and more adult-like, and that's because the brain is becoming so interconnected, and this really improves kids' abilities to regulate their emotions and their thinking and their behavior.
So a couple of questions. That 14-year kind of window in the growth of the adolescent child is a really tumultuous one. I just see so many kids at the age of 14, 15 going off the rails. You know, they just, you know, so emotionally explosive and talk about risky behaviors, leaving home. There's a lot that goes on. you know, why is that so volatile? And what mostly, I guess, the question is, what do parents need to know, or what do teachers need to know? How do you navigate a child through that stage of their development safely and support them?
Well, you know, there's a style of parenting that I describe in the book that we psychologists call authoritative parenting. And this is parenting that during adolescence combines being warm, being firm, and being supportive of your child's interest in becoming a more independent person. The key for parents is that in order to be effective, you need to do all three of these things. You can't just pick and choose. We know that kids who are raised in households where their parents are warm but not firm, these are households that we call permissive or indulgent, that kids raised that way tend to have more behavior problems, and they tend to be more easily influenced by their peers. They're more susceptible to peer pressure. So you really need to combine them. On the other hand, kids who are raised in households where the parents are firm but not warm, you know, this is a style that I think now people are calling tiger mothering, maybe, that they don't do well either, that this increases kids' risks for anxiety and depression. And so I think that learning how to be a good authoritative parent during adolescence is probably the most important way that we can support people while they're going through this time. I think the message is that it doesn't have to be tumultuous if you and your adolescent understand what's taking place during this stage. And one of the reasons that I wrote Age of Opportunity was to try to correct what I think is an erroneous a stereotype of adolescence, which is that it's something that needs to be survived or endured. If you go to the bookstore and you look on the shelves for where they stock books for parents of teenagers, you'll find a lot of survival guides. It is really just astounding how many books for parents and for teenagers have the word survivor, survival in the title. And I think that creates the wrong impression. And I think that it creates the impression that there's kind of nothing you can do but hold your breath and get through it. And that's wrong. Because I think that we now know that because the brain is so plastic, that adolescence is a time when people can really thrive if we take advantage of the opportunity.
And I think that's such an important point. We need to know how to help our children navigate through this stage of life, and we need to know how to, as parents and as teachers, counselors, people who are engaging with teenagers, need to know how to help navigate them. So you optimize the growth and support these children to become more resourceful within themselves, more balanced as well.
Right. And a technique that that's very important for parents and teachers to learn is something that we call scaffolding, which is challenging your child to do a little bit more intellectually or emotionally than what he or she is capable of doing, but doing that in a way that makes the challenge something that the child can meet. So if your expectations for your child are so far removed from what your child is capable of, they will be overwhelming. On the other hand, if you don't expect anything, your child really won't grow and thrive. And so by scaffolding these experiences, you're setting your child up to succeed, and you're really contributing to your child's intellectual and emotional growth and well-being.
Can you give an example of that?
Yes. So a good example of that might be when you feel it's comfortable to leave your child at home alone when you're not there. So imagine this is probably going to start taking place in most households when the child is around 11 or 12 years old. And you wouldn't start this by leaving your child home alone in the evening for 5 hours. And that's going to be scary and anxiety-producing for some kids, and for others it's going to be a license to get into trouble. So instead, you might scaffold this experience and start by letting your child stay home alone in the afternoon while you go over to a neighbor's house and where you're right, you know, nearby. And then you gradually might increase that amount of time and change the time of day little by little so that your child understands how to master this experience. So that's what I mean by scaffolding, kind of gently and gradually increasing your expectations for the child's developing sense of autonomy and independence.
Great. That's a great example. What's the difference between male and female brains, or is there a difference? And during this adolescent period, and their how they travel through this stage of life.
You know, there's a difference, but to be honest, I don't think it's a difference that has a lot of practical significance to it. One thing that we do know is that this arousal of the brain's reward centers is driven much more by testosterone than by estrogen, so it is it's more intense in males than females, and that's why adolescent boys engage in a lot more risky behavior than adolescent girls do. But there's an increase in arousal in girls as well. It just isn't as steep as it is in boys. And we do see an increase in risky behavior in girls as well, but just not as big an increase. On the other hand, in all of our studies, we find that girls have better self-control, self-regulation than boys at all ages throughout the adolescent and young adult years. That also has to do with some differences in the way that their brains are built. Having said all that, I don't think that the differences are large enough to say that parents or teachers or society's institutions should treat males and females differently during adolescence. There's no evidence, as far as I know, that boys and girls learn in different ways. And there's no evidence suggesting at all that they respond to different kinds of parenting. So that authoritative parenting style that I described a moment ago is just as effective with males as it is with females. And it's the best way to parent adolescents, regardless of their gender.
You know, in the book you talked about the good purpose for risky behavior as part of a developmental stage of life that we need to go through. You know, when I think of risky behavior, I think of 15, 16, 7-year-olds, you know, hot rodding and, you know, a lot of it is around driving their cars. Of course, there's drinking, binge drinking and such. First of all, I think it's important to help us understand the good purpose for that risky behavior stage of life, what's happening in the brain. And then what are your suggestions to help, you know, support parents, support children, teenagers in taking behaviors, which is a necessary part of growth, but do it in a way that isn't destructive?
So one way to better understand this is to start by thinking about evolution and what adolescence is there for as a period of development. Why do we go through adolescence? We can learn a lot by looking at other animals because all mammals go through puberty. And when mammals go through puberty, they undergo behavioral changes that are somewhat similar to what we see in human adolescents around the time of puberty too. One of the changes that mammals go through then is to begin thinking about reproduction. I'm using thinking kind of as a broad term. I'm not sure how much thinking mice do, but they're motivated by this hormonal changes of puberty to go out and seek mates. And in many species, particularly in primates, that has to be done by leaving one's mother and the adults that have protected you. And going off into the wild. I mean, in some primate species, like baboons, if juvenile baboons don't leave when they go through puberty, their parents actually kick them out. So what this means is that in order to survive at this age, you need to be willing to take risks. Because going out, you know, leaving the adults that have protected you your whole time growing up as an infant or a child, and competing with bigger and stronger animals for mates, and sometimes having to do this on your own in the wild, is very risky. So we think that we evolved to be more risk tolerant during adolescence and to be more willing to take risks, because if we didn't do that, we wouldn't reproduce. Now, of course, in today's world, where we meet people whom we're romantically interested in on the internet, not out in the woods, this trait is no longer particularly adaptive. But it's in our genes, and it's a part of who we are. And so, adolescent risk taking is a normative behavior. The challenge for us as parents and educators and practitioners is to see if we can channel this risk-taking inclination into positive behaviors rather than dangerous ones. There are a number of ways we can do that. The first is by trying to limit adolescents' time and access to dangerous situations. I'll give you an example of that. We know that experimentation with sex and drugs and delinquency is more common now during the late afternoon hours than it is on weekends or in the evenings. 3 to 6 p.m. in the afternoon is the prime time for experimentation with these things. And that's because, no surprise, this is when adolescents are often out on their own, unsupervised, in unstructured activities, and hanging around in their homes. So one way to try to deter this risky behavior that kids engage in during these hours is to get our schools and our communities to provide more after-school activities for kids this age that are fun and stimulating, but that are structured and that are supervised. And this will diminish the amount of time kids have on their own to get themselves into trouble. Because that's what I mean by trying to create situations that are going to minimize kids' involvement in dangerous and risky activity. Another good example of this comes from research on teen smoking. Though, we don't want our kids to smoke cigarettes. It's very bad for you. It's a very addictive behavior for lots of people. We have struggled with some success at bringing rates of smoking down. But this has not been achieved primarily by teaching kids about the dangers of smoking. It's been achieved by raising the price of cigarettes, which makes it harder for kids to get them, which therefore makes it less likely that they're going to smoke. So these are some examples of things we can do just to simply make it more difficult for adolescents to take dangerous risks. On the other hand, I think we want to encourage our kids to engage in positive risk-taking, to take classes where they're not guaranteed that they're going to get A's, to try out for extracurricular activities that they might be a little bit nervous about trying out for, like going out for a party in the school play or trying out for a sports team that they're not guaranteed to make, or even just, asking somebody out that you're nervous about talking to. So there are all kinds of risks that we want our teenagers to take, and I think the challenge for us really is to direct them toward the positive ones and to keep them away from the negative ones.
Well, those are some really great points that you brought up, and I think the more we understand what's going on, the more we can support our children, and as you were saying, encourage them in positive ways. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're talking with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg, who has written a fantastic book called Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, and it's really shedding light on what's going on with our teenagers, how we can understand their brains, support them to optimize this period of their life so they can emerge on the other side more resourceful and filled with the joy of exploring the rest of their life. I have a question I'd like to ask. There is a lot of, when you talk about risky behavior, a lot of concern about alcohol. I spend a lot of time in Australia, and binge drinking is of epidemic proportion in that part of the world. It's probably true in the U.S. I just hear about it more in Australia. And I don't know whether it is associated with binge drinking, but there is a high rate of teen suicide going on in Australia, particularly amongst males. Do you have any insights about that?
Well, we know that that drinking is something that it makes us feel good temporarily, but in the long run makes us feel bad. So we know that drinking leads to depression, and depression is, of course, associated with suicide. So I'm not surprised when you talk about them going hand in hand in Australia. Binge drinking is very common in the United States as well during adolescence and young adulthood. And we have a suicide rate among adolescents in the United States that's above the world average. We're nowhere near at the top of the list, but we're higher than most countries. So we do want to do whatever we can to discourage kids from using alcohol during adolescence, and of course from binge drinking as well. I mentioned before when we were talking about changes in the brain that occur in early adolescence that the brain, because it's very plastic during this time, is much more easily harmed by substances. So let me just put some numbers on that for a second. Your chances of developing a substance abuse problem or an addiction as an adult are 7 to 10 times greater if you start using recreational drugs, and this is true for alcohol and tobacco and cocaine and marijuana, I think, as well. Your chances of developing an addiction are 7 to 10 times greater if you start using those substances before the age of 15 than if you wait until you're 21 years old. So it is very, very important to keep our young adolescents in particular away from them. So a lot of binge drinking that we see in the late adolescent and young adult years is probably related to early experimentation with alcohol, which changes the brain in ways that makes us crave that substance.
So what do parents do around this issue?
Well, I think that you stay firm around it, and you talk to your kids about it. I think that now that we have the brain science here, and kids find this stuff fascinating, you explain to them, you know, how it affects their brain differently. I mean, I think that, you know, before we had this brain science, kids would look at their parents having their, you know, martini before dinner or their wine with dinner and say, well, you tell me not to drink, but you do. I don't think we had a terrifically good response to that in the past, but now we have a very good response, which is that these things are much worse for your brain when you're your age than when you're my age. And when you're my age, when you're an adult, you can make a decision about what you want to do. But for now, you're not allowed to use these substances. And I think, again, it goes to something I was saying earlier about having healthy after-school activities for kids. If we know this, and we know it from so much research, that unstructured, unsupervised time during adolescence is a recipe for experimentation with drugs and sex and alcohol. So don't let your kid be in unsupervised, unstructured settings, as much as you can. Now, we can't control this 100% of the time. I don't think that parents should approach parenting as something where, if you're not batting 1,000, then you might as well be batting 0. I think that parenting is something where we can all do it a little bit better, and the more frequently we parent well, the better off our kids are going to be. And keeping our kids away from alcohol and other drugs is one of the things that good parents do.
Do you find that having your teenager read your book or go through parts of the book or chapters and becoming more self-aware of themselves at that stage is making a difference for them?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that. The book has only been out for 3 weeks, so it's kind of hard to tell.
What do you think?
let me just say that when I give public lectures, as I do frequently, and I do them sometimes to parent groups and sometimes to practitioners and sometimes to teachers and sometimes to kids. And kids are really interested in this stuff. So I think that they would be interested in the book as well because they're at an age during adolescence where they're curious about what's happening to them. And You know, we have terrific books out there for adolescents about what's happening to their bodies. We have fewer resources for adolescents that explain what's happening to their brains. A very good one, by the way, is a book by my friend Dan Siegel called Brainstorm, which he wrote specifically to be read by teenagers, which explains what's going on in the brain at a level that most adolescents can understand. But I think my book as well is something that teenagers can get a lot out of, because I think as somebody who teaches people, and a lot of the people that I teach as a college professor are adolescents, they're interested in this. I did a talk last night, really, at a university in Southern California, and the audience was almost all college undergraduates, and they were really interested in this stuff.
Well, I think it would be of great interest. I always think the more we can understand what makes us tick, the more we can embrace this information, find it useful, and have it help us. So I think it would be well received. I'm sure everyone wants to understand themselves better and how to behave better and get better results out of their life. Sounds like it would be a great thing to do and to teach in school and to just help that greater awareness be disseminated through our community.
Right, let me just point out an added benefit of this, which is that it's a great way to get kids interested in science, because I think that today, an educated person needs to know something about the brain. I mean, just think about how often you pick up the paper or listen on the radio or see something on television that involves how our brains work. And so neuroscience is becoming an increasingly important part of what an educated person needs to know. And I think it's a terrific way to introduce students, middle school students and high school students, to science, to start by talking about their own brain. And that then leads you into many different discussions that touch upon biology and psychology and chemistry and things that we want our kids to be interested in and to learn about.
Absolutely. I think that definitely will stimulate more curiosity for the kids. Would for me. Here's something else I wanted to ask you. Have you looked into the role of nutrition, the role of meditation, the role of exercise in helping the development of the adolescent brain?
Yes. It's not something that I study directly, but it's something that I certainly know a lot about and read a lot about in writing Age of Opportunity. We know that aerobic exercise is probably the single most important thing that you can do to keep your brain healthy. And that's true actually at all ages. I think a lot of people have been maybe misled into believing that the most important thing that they need to do for their brains is to play games and puzzles and download these applications that are supposedly strengthening your memory and things like that. There's nothing the matter with those activities. There's not a lot of research that says that they do a great deal to the brain. There are some exceptions to that. But we do know that aerobic exercise is terrific for your brain. And so it's very important that adolescents get adequate exercise during this period of brain plasticity when the brain is changing. We know that one of the things that we've taken out of schools is physical education. And it's really a shame that now the majority of kids who get exercise every day are the star athletes and not sort of the average kids. And so as a parent, it's important to make sure that your child gets sufficient exercise. A second is sleep. Sleep is very important during adolescence for healthy development, psychological as well as brain development. And we know that we have a country of sleep-deprived teenagers. The recommended guideline is that adolescents sleep 9 hours a night. And that's difficult to do because our schools start so early. And there have been some very nicely done experiments in which school districts shifted their start time for high school to a later hour of the day. Lo and behold, they found a big increase in their students' achievement and school performance. Mm-hmm. So It's important that your kids get enough sleep. And then, eating well is also really critical. We have an obesity epidemic among our children. It's one of the factors that's contributed to early puberty, which, as we discussed before, is not good for you. And so it's very important that parents make sure that their kids eat right.
Well, it seemed to me if we can bring some of those strategies into play so kids are having a healthy diet, they're getting the exercise, they're supported with sleep, it would make the adolescent's journey a lot smoother. Just kind of common sense, isn't it?
It is, but I think, sometimes common sense isn't followed very commonly. Some other activities that are looking very promising for kids at this age are those involving mindfulness. So there is a growing body of research on mindfulness meditation in particular, suggesting that this is also very good for your brain. That, you remember earlier we were talking about the stage of adolescent brain development where the brain is becoming more interconnected, and meditation seems to help that process along. And in the book I talk about, the idea, which some schools are now doing, of incorporating mindfulness training into the school curriculum as a way of building these important psychological characteristics. Schools should be playing a role in helping to facilitate kids' psychological development more generally and not simply teaching them academic skills. And I talk at length in Age of Opportunity about some things that schools can be doing to help build things like self-control, self-regulation, persistence, and determination, all of which turn out to be better predictors of success in school and in work than intelligence. And so schools can do a much better job there.
And that would seem to be a big part of your research and the message you are communicating. It's not just for parents to understand this. It's not just for our children to understand more about themselves. But how do you apply this research? How do you apply this knowledge in environments that can have a huge influence on the development of children, like in the school system where they spend so much of their time? Do you see your message being received? Is there a receptive audience in school systems?
I think so. I think that those of us who study the adolescent brain have done a reasonably good job of getting information out to the public, and the public's desire for information about the adolescent brain is very high. So you see cover stories on magazines and specials on television and on radio that deal with the adolescent brain. So I think there is a great interest in it. It's not always immediately evident what the practical implications are. We're having a better understanding of that. One place in which I've done a fair amount of work, as you mentioned when you introduced me, is in the application of adolescent brain science to our policies involving kids in the justice system. So one of the arguments that we made when we submitted briefs to the Supreme Court in the juvenile death penalty case and in the ones that followed it, is that, look, we know that the brain is still maturing during adolescence and that kids are not adults, and that even when they commit serious crimes, that doesn't turn them magically into adults, and that we need to respond to them differently. We need to hold them responsible for their behavior and punish them if necessary. But we need to keep in mind that they're not as responsible for what they do as adults are, and they're not deserving of the same level of harsh punishment that adults might be deserving of. And in terms of very long sentences that we've also tried to fight against for kids, that it is a time, because the brain is so malleable, during which people are much better candidates for rehabilitation. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to take somebody who's 14 or 15 years old and has committed a terrible crime and lock him up for life, because there's a very good chance that he can be treated and rehabilitated in a way that's going to allow him to rejoin the community and be a fully active and participating citizen. So there's an example of where we have made some inroads. by bringing brain science to the attention of our courts and our legislators.
And that's so profound, because we really need to understand there's a definite distinction between an adolescent brain and an adult's brain. I would imagine if you get an adolescent into the system and you don't understand that, you can be creating hardened criminals as a result.
Well, there's there's been this a series of horror stories that have emerged in New York City about the treatment of adolescents at Rikers Island, which is a prison facility, where they were putting kids who are, 15, 16 years old into solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to think of too many things that would be worse for your brain at a point in time when you need contact with other people and relationships with other people and stimulation in order to develop well, than being isolated like that. And so if you look at how we treat a lot of kids that come into the justice system, it's little surprise that we have a very high recidivism rate. We have a high recidivism rate because we don't respond to kids in ways that are going to make them better. We treat them in ways that we know are going to make them worse. And that's why for lots of kids that get into trouble with the law, the justice system becomes this revolving door where they come into the system, where they're treated poorly and not given rehabilitative services, and isolated from their parents, and having their school life disrupted. And then when they finish their sentences, they're released back into the community. They fall in with the same peer group that they were in with before, and, no surprise, they get picked up for another offense pretty quickly. So we really need to overhaul this system in a way that's consistent with what we're learning about the adolescent brain.
So we really have a window of opportunity with these children to, as you said, rehabilitate them, turn them around, and get them to function more effectively back into society. This conversation kind of leads me to one more question. We're kind of coming to the end of the conversation, but what about these 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who are enrolled into military service, going to the Army, going into Marines, being put into active service? This is kind of scary for me, actually, after listening to everything we've been talking about.
Well, we actually have a grant from the Army to study people this age with respect to exactly the issues that you're raising. A very high proportion of people in the military, particularly the Marines, are adolescents. Very high proportion of people in the military are under 21 years old, one of the reasons that countries recruit people this age to do their fighting for them is that people this age are not so afraid to take risks. It's no surprise. But the question really is, what's the nature of the training and supervision that we provide to people this age? The research that we're doing now is comparing decision-making among 19-year-olds when they're by themselves with 19-year-olds who are mixed in with adults, to see if having adults present in these groups of young men helps them make better decisions. We don't have any answers yet. We just started this work. But we're hoping that we can provide the Army with some helpful information that's going to save a lot of lives and improve the quality of decision-making that our young men in combat make.
Well, I think if we understand that the brains of adolescents are definitely more vulnerable, if we put them in a highly stressful situation or a violent situation, it could be leading to more post-traumatic stress syndrome, or maybe the reason why we have such a high incidence of post-traumatic stress in returning veterans.
Yep, we're studying that very thing right now, to look to see whether the impact of combat stress on psychological functioning is worse for younger people than for slightly older people. I know that we're short on time, but just wanted to mention the interesting study that was published earlier this year about the impact of growing up during wartime on life expectancy. So as you would imagine. It's not good for anybody to grow up during a war. It's stressful, and that takes years off of our life. But it turns out that if you grow up during a war you're an adolescent during that time period, it takes more years off of your life than if you grew up during the very same war, but you're a child or an adult. And that's because the adolescent brain is very responsive to stress.
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, scary statistics. Well, to kind of wrap things up, do you just have a few more comments you want to make and any other key things that we need to address before we complete our conversation today?
Well, I just want to, you know, leave with, you know, what I hope is an optimistic, you know, inspiring message, which is that we need to stop thinking about adolescence as something to be survived. And we need to start thinking about it as a time when people can really thrive. That's the main message of Age of Opportunity, that we stop thinking about adolescence as a problem and start thinking about it as an opportunity.
And I love that message, because every stage of life, when we understand the keys of what can support that stage so we can take advantage of that part of our life's journey, will just allow us to become more of who we are. And I really appreciate the work you're doing and the great contribution you are making in understanding the gifts of the adolescent brain and how to help everyone, including teenagers themselves, take advantage of that stage of a life, come through it with strengths and not weaknesses. So thank you so much for this wonderful book, Dr. Lauren Steinberg. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and good luck and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you very much, and I enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. It's been a pleasure, and I encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. For joining me today, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You've been listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.